Well, it was Good Friday and the radio was chock-a-block with great interviews. Julie Andrews on Mary Poppins and the Sound of Music. Irish actor Amy de Bruyn talks about being cast in Line of Duty. And Mary O'Rourke gets her second jab. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
I'm so longing to have a big hug, a good tight hug from them. And that's what I'm looking forward to, mostly.
Suddenly this larger-than-life personality came into my life and was alcoholic. It was not easy, but again, it's what we were handed as kids, and I guess we got on with it.
Funny, I always just say I misspent youth watching Brookside. I used to be obsessed with that programme. So as a child, very strange. There you go.
Well, let's start here on Callan's Kicks and signing up to be a vaccinator. Ain't as easy as you'd think.
Got to do the routes, all right.
Hello.
Hello, vaccinators registration hotline. These calls are monitored by HSC outsourcing contractors for invoicing quality and toilet training purposes.
Yeah, I'd like to sign up as a vaccinator, please.
Do you have any vaccinating experience?
Yes, I'm a general practitioner.
But that's not strictly relevant here. Do you have any valid vaccinating experience?
I administer thousands of flu vaccines every single winter.
This is a COVID-19 vaccine, not an influenza vaccine.
But
I'll just mark that down as no experience.
No, so I'm a...
Any relevant qualifications?
Yes, I received my MD degree from Trinity College in 2000.
That's not really the type of information we're looking for. What? Do you have your junior certs results handy?
Well, I'd have to look them up.
Let's see, were you a recipient of an Ungoshka President's Award?
I think I...
Any Sports Day medals?
Yes, I have a few.
Did you ever win a can of Coke at the Coca-Cola Fun Factory Tour?
Yes, I did, actually.
Did you ever own a Henry Hippo piggy bank from Ulster Bank? And can you provide photographic evidence of said piggy bank?
I don't think I've got any photos.
See, this is the sort of thing you really need to be keeping a record of if you want to be a vaccinator.
I'm sorry, I didn't realise that it was...
An ethics question now. Would you give someone a vaccine if they offered you a monetary reward for it?
Absolutely not.
One of those.
What?
Finally, do you have any family members sitting on boards of the following? EY, the Davy Group, VHI, the Beacon Hospital, St. Gerard's Catholic School, the Iraqis Golf Society, the Handmaid's Tale Association, the Michael Lowry Trust, or the Hellfire Club.
No.
From Callan's Kicks. And in the afternoon, Aideen Gormley, stars of stage and screen and the woman who formed a bit of most of our childhoods as Mary Poppins and Maria from The Sound of Music, Julie Andrews.
Julie Andrews, it's so lovely to have you with us. We have so much to talk about. But as you'd say yourself, let's start at the very beginning. When did those around you first notice your voice was no ordinary voice and that you had this extraordinary range and a fully formed larynx from an early age? What was the reaction?
Well, my mother had married my stepfather and I had gone to live with them and was not particularly happy at the whole situation. As you can imagine, I missed my dad and those kind of things. But my stepfather tried very hard to make contact, be more gentle with me, but I wasn't having any of it. But he, because of the war, because my school was closed due to the escalation of the war, because I was probably underfoot, and I think he wanted to try to get closer to me. And he was a fine tenor. He was a Canadian, my stepfather. And he had a wonderful singing voice. And so he decided to give me some singing lessons. I cannot imagine why. But he and my mother discovered that I had this freak 4-octave range. And this was when I was about 7 years old.
Gosh.
And I could do amazing sort of gymnastics with this voice. And it was excruciatingly high and a sort of white, thin sound, but very powerful. So my stepfather very quickly realized that I needed a proper teacher if anything was going to happen. And so he found for me a wonderful woman called Lillian Stiles Allen, who was my teacher until the day she died, which was at the ripe old age of 90-something. So she was a wonderful mentor for me.
What were the most important techniques she taught you?
Oh, my. Well, singing is such a personal thing, but her basic techniques, you know, not letting the voice slip back on the throat, a good diction, making your words hold the, if you're true to your vowels and your and have strong consonants, then your voice will hold true for you. And everything about placement of the voice, breathing, and as I say, diction.
Well, yes, I mean, when I think of you, I just think of perfect diction.
Well, I think she was hugely responsible for that.
You were singing, though, I know, some difficult opera arias with her. Was she pushing you towards an operatic voice initially, you know, instead of a voice to musical theatre? Yeah.
Yes, I think she hoped I would certainly do opera or light opera. I always somehow knew, I'm not sure how I knew, that my voice was too thin and white for the strength required for certainly for grand opera, and I wasn't sure that light opera was for me anyway, but I certainly practiced it all my during my early years, which gave me this huge foundation so that when I eventually found musical comedy, which felt so right and became so joyous for me, I had gone beyond that in my range and in my technique and in my work. So it was wonderfully easy to encompass it most of the time.
So there you are, as a young girl with an extraordinary talent. You became a child performer with your mother and your stepfather, Ted Andrews. Was your mother what we would refer to as a stage mother? Was she pushing you forward all the time?
She seemed to alternate. I, compared to some stage mums that I've seen, I would say she wasn't really your average stage mum. There were days when she was extremely proud of me, and there were days when she really held me in my place and said, don't you dare get a swollen head, and don't you dare complain about things. And I was kept very much in my place, which I think was good for me. Mm-hmm. So I guess in certain areas she was, but I think it was as I was useful too. My parents were, my mother and my stepfather were very poor. My voice helped by joining their act. I helped contribute to the family coffers and so on. So yes, she was a bit of a stage mum, but certainly not you wouldn't have thought so from the image that I've seen with other stage mums over the years.
And Julie spoke about her stepfather, Ted Andrews.
He was a powerful man. Seemed to be physical in every way. My father was a lovely, nature-loving teacher who accorded his children a great deal of dignity and respect and treated them as beloved equals. And suddenly this larger-than-life personality came into my life and was alcoholic and difficult. And it was not easy, but again, it's what we were handed as kids, and I guess we got on with it.
Through it all, you appear to have grown up a well-adjusted, balanced person. You've no drink or drug dependencies. You know, you made it through and you handled what life threw at you very well. How?
Well, I guess thanks to my mother and father. As I say, my dad was the man I knew as my dad was sane and level and gave me the kind of exposure to all great things like nature and literature and things that I needed to keep my sanity. And my mother was all the colour and flair in my life that gave me my love of theatre and so on. Between the two of them, they must have, in spite of being divorced, they must have done something right, because I was also aware, really aware, of how blessed I was to have a talent. I think if I hadn't had the gift of my voice, I probably might have been a very lost, rather foolish child. But because I had that talent and because I had a gift and the responsibility of actually looking after the family a great deal, I think those kind of obligations dominated and luckily, I made it through. I mean, teens are never easy for any kid, but I got through them.
Julie Andrews in conversation with Aideen Gormley, and we'll come back to that a bit later in the programme. And on Today with Claire Byrne, The Hitmen, a family of killers for hire. Claire was talking to Stephen Breen, author of a new book looking at the Wilsons.
Meet the Wilsons, the deadliest family in crime. Brothers Eric, Keith and John Wilson and their cousin Alan and also their nephew Luke shared a trade, assassination. Working for Ireland's criminal gangs, they brought bloodshed and chaos to the streets, both here and abroad. A new book outlines how they worked their way up through the criminal ranks, and Stephen Breen, author of The Hitmen, joins me on the line now. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Claire.
This is an extraordinary story because, you know, it has the family, the cousin, the nephew and so on. Will you explain to us in basic terms, who are the Wilsons?
So the Wilsons are three brothers. That's John, Eric and Keith from the Ballyfermot area. And also their nephew, Luke, who's also from Ballyfermot. And their first cousin, Alan Wilson, who's from the Kevin Street area. And what's unusual about the Wilsons is that throughout the years, since 2001, they were all heavily involved in organised crime. But namely for the Wilsons, at one point over the last 20 years or another, they all worked as cartel contract killers for various criminal gangs and were involved in a number of serious incidents, both here and also in Europe as well.
It wasn't a surprise, though, that they fell into a life of criminality.
No, it wasn't, because their father died when they were young. John, who was the elder member of the family, took on, you know, the mantle of the support group in the family. He was the one they all looked up to. They called him John. John was his family name. But he was someone in his teenage years got involved in petty crime, joyriding, car theft. But then that escalated in 2001 when the Gardaí suspected that he was involved in a murder of an individual. And his part in the murder was to act as a getaway driver. So, but from the noughties onwards, and then from 2005, the next brother, Eric Wilson, emerges as a suspect, even though he's only 21, in the gangland killing. So throughout the years since the start of the new century, their progression in organised crime continues until it obviously comes to fruition when they're all brought before the courts in different matters.
So, like, you know, that old trope, it started with the petty crime, it developed on from mm-hmm. there.
It did start with petty crime, and that's the same with all the brothers. In this case, when you have the three brothers, so you have John, who's involved in petty crime, that progresses to his involvement in acting as enforcer for different crime gangs in the city, because he was a big guy, he was well built, and he was intimidating. And the other two brothers, because they were looking up to him, they followed on the same path as well, because they were also involved in petty crime, car theft, assaults, intimidation. But again, that escalated for Eric and for Keith when they were involved in two murders. Yeah.
So what about the three brothers then, Eric, Keith and John Wilson? Mm. Stephen, what do we know about their mother?
Yeah, so they live in Ballyfermot. Their mother was very close to their children. Their mother effectively reared the children. They had another sister called Debbie, who unfortunately died from a drugs overdose in 2008. So because they had lost their father at a young age, she was a pivotal figure in the family dynamic there. And she was someone who stood by her children, wasn't afraid to help them, you know, if they were involved in any skirmishes when they were younger or anything. And was someone who was quite a strong character in the family home.
So when the crimes became much more serious, they gained a reputation pretty quickly as being not afraid to use a gun.
That's correct. And it started with Eric Wilson. So in 2005, he emerges as a suspect in a gangland killing. It is quickly followed in 2006 and 2007. He emerges as another suspect in two other killings in the Drogheda area. But it escalates in 2010 when Eric Wilson goes to Spain. He's living there at that time because he's on the run from the Gardaí after a weapons find in Carlow. So he goes to Spain. He's living in a remote area of Mijas. And when he's living there, he frequents this pub called The Lounge in the Costa del Sol. He's there, people get to know him. His nickname is Lucky. He builds up a good reputation there. He has friends there. But on one night, he gets involved in an argument with another criminal called Daniel Smith. He leaves the bar, goes to his ranch, then returns to the bar sometime later and proceeds to shoot Dan Smith 8 times. He's then arrested by the Spanish police, and they're amazed when they find him living in this isolated area, that not only has he been arrested on suspicion of murder, they recover huge amounts of weaponry such as plastic explosives, tanks, grenades and AK-47 ammunition. So that's when he is finally brought to bear and brought to justice because of his involvement in that brutal murder.
And Stephen spoke about how they became hitmen for hire.
Yeah, you had various gangs across Dublin at that time. So Eric especially was offering his service, and for him all along was the pursuit of profit for money. That's the only reason he was doing this. There was no value placed on human life. So you had people like Marlo Highland before his death in 2006 recruiting Eric Wilson. You had people like the Associates of John Gilligan in West Dublin, other criminals in the Dublin area. And then we see in 2010 as Sean Hunt, a veteran smuggler from Ballyfermot, knows the Wilsons very well. He recruits Keith Wilson to shoot and kill an individual in 2010. That's Daniel Gaynor. So their services were being offered across the board to various criminal groupings. And then we see, as the later stages of their career, in 2017, both Alan and Luke Wilson get involved with the Kinahan cartel.
Now, I want to go back to 2008, because the Garda investigation into the disappearance and the subsequent murder of the Romanian teenager Mariora Roștas was painstaking for Gardaí, but nobody has ever been convicted of her murder. Alan Wilson was exonerated in court and found not guilty. Can you take us back to that case, Stephen, and tell us a little bit about Mariora and what happened to her?
Well, Mariora Roștas was a Romanian teenager who joined her family in Ireland in December 2007. She'd only been here 3 weeks when her family were begging in Dublin city centre. They had come here in the hope of a better life, hoping to get some work. Because of the language barriers, her father had been unable to find work, so they had to resort to begging. It was seen as something that in Romanian culture, you know, people could get involved in. So she was Romanian in the city, living in a very a rundown place in North Dublin. On the January the 6th, 2008, she was begging with her younger brother and also with her family. And a car pulled up alongside her and her brother. Off an individual offered her 10 euros and offered to get her some McDonald's. And she got into the car and was never seen again then. So her family then reported her missing, and the Gardaí in Pear Street launched an immediate investigation. But at that time, the Gardaí had nothing substantial to go on. They were concerned that she was perhaps the victim of a child trafficking ring. She was a victim of an arranged marriage. And there was no idea what had happened until June of that year, when a phone call came through to the Pear Street Garda station with an anonymous call where they had said that Alan Wilson was a possible suspect in this case. He was the nephew of either Martin Foley or Martin Cahill, the general. But that was followed up in September of that year by another call naming Alan Wilson as having been involved in this girl's murder and disappearance. And that's when the Garda investigation took on a whole new role. But it really developed at the latter stages of 2010 and 2011, when Alan Wilson's sister, her partner, Fergus O'Hanlon, decided to turn against Alan Wilson, and he was the person who led Gardaí to her remains being found in the Wicklow Mountains.
And he is now in the Witness Protection Programme as a result.
He will always be in the Witness Protection Programme. It was his decision to come forward. Him and Alan Wilson at one stage were the best of friends. They were very close. There was a close bond there, and a family bond as well, because of his relationship with Maxine Wilson. And his decision to testify against Alan Wilson during his trial in 2014 led to him going into the Witness Protection Programme. And in the book as well, we detailed Fergus O'Hanlon's interactions with the Gardaí, his interviews where he talks about his fears, his concerns for his family and his well-being, and ultimately as well, the decision for him to come forward and lead Gardaí to the teenager's remains being found on a lonely mountainside.
And ultimately, Alan Wilson was found not guilty of that crime. Where is that case at now, that investigation? Will we ever see anybody, given the investigations that you have carried out, Stephen, brought to justice for the murder of Mariora Roștas?
The case remains open. I spoke to Mario Arostas' family a number of years ago, and you know, they gave us quite a lengthy interview and thanking the people of Ireland, thanking the Gardaí, thanking the government for arranging her repatriation to Romania. And it was their hope that, obviously, Alan Mulson had been cleared of this murder. It was their hope that someday they would see justice. But the priority for that family at the time in 2012 was to find out what happened to their daughter and then to give her a Christian burial that she deserved.
Stephen Breen from Today with Claire Byrne. And back to the stars of stage and screen and Aideen Gormley's interview with Julie Andrews and, of course, one of her defining roles, Mary Poppins.
All of a sudden, out of the blue, along comes Walt Disney, who did want new talent, fresh talent, and ask me to do Mary Poppins. So how could I bitch or be unhappy when those kind of incredible slices of good fortune were coming my way?
And I suppose not a bad day when Walt Disney himself wants you to play the lead in his latest film. We know Walt had quite a fraught relationship with Mary Poppins author P.L. Travers, but you seem to get on really well with him.
Yes, I don't think it was necessary. Walt was, you know, supremely tactful and decent and a gentleman, and I probably wasn't too much his fault with Pamela Travers, who was charming, but understandably protective about her property, and I can understand it, but he gave us so many assurances, and it took him a long time to get the rights to the books.
The first bit of trivia you give us about this film, Julie, just a few pages in, made me laugh out loud, and that was that Dick Van Dyke, as we know, struggled a little with the Cockney accent. You tell us in chapter one that the nationality of the man who helped him out with his accent was...
Irish.
Irish.
Yes, that's right. I had to think for a minute because I was helping as well as much as I could.
Yes, you say that it was an Irish actor, J.P. O'Malley, who voiced indeed several of the animated characters in Mary Poppins, who tried to coach him.
Yes, he did, and was a lovely guy. But I don't quite know how that worked, Aideen, but there you are.
You mentioned that it was a learning curve for you to work out the difference between recording a Broadway cast album, normally done after the show, and in this case it was different because you were going to record the songs before filming. How did you find that?
Well, everything about film was so completely different to being on stage. You obviously, being on stage, you're in the moment. You start at the beginning and go to the end, and everything is in full figure, and you have to think about that. But you put it to bed, so to speak, every night in performance. But with a film, you hold the entire film in your head, and you could start in the middle and shoot the ending and maybe shoot the beginning, as I did in Sound of Music, at the very, very end of the movie.
You say with Mary Poppins, in terms of a first film to make, that it just taught you so much in a short period of time.
Well, it was such a complicated film with all the special effects and live action and animation and so many tricks.
And of course, you were working out what was required vocally, say, for an action sequence or if you were in front of a giant yellow screen.
That's right. Well, the recording side of it, which is what you were asking, is you have to know or anticipate at least what kind of movement you'll be doing. Are you breathless? Are you having a riotously good time? Are you quiet and reflective and sending a child to sleep? And you have to try to imagine. Sometimes it's impossible to, but a lot of the time, if you have choreography and you've been rehearsing it, you can get an idea of what's required. But it's not that easy at times.
I love in this book how you go into detail on the various songs, and we'll come to The Sound of Music in a moment. But just staying with Mary Poppins, you mentioned, of course, you know, Jolly Holiday filmed in front of a giant yellow screen. And I love what you say about supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, because it reminded you of the patter songs of your vaudeville days.
It did. And, you know, it was so like those musical theatres where everybody did their kind of rumpty-tum kind of songs, walking back and forth and up and down the stage. And I thought in the days when I was in vaudeville, what good is it doing me? And then, of course, nothing in life, I discover, is wasted. And those years were very useful to me when it came to making Poppins.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay. Just summon up this word and then you've got a lot to say. But better use it carefully or it could change your life.
For example?
Yes?
One night I said it to me girl and now me girl's me wife.
From Mary Poppins, and we'll catch up again with that interview with Julie Andrews where she talks about The Sound of Music. And on the Ryan Tipperty Show, one of the biggest shows on the TV at the moment is Line of Duty. Its twisty plot and superb acting has millions of viewers hooked. So in the morning, Ryan spoke to actor Amy De Bruyne about being part of something so big and the payoff to a long road of hard graft.
It's definitely been a long road. So to be on a show like that, especially at a time like this, just feels incredible.
Tell me briefly about the long road.
Of my journey.
Yeah, of your journey.
I started when I was 19. I went to drama school in London, and from there it was just a lot of, you know, writing my own shows, creating my own theatre companies, just doing tiny parts and, you know, in independent films and things like that. And then slowly, you know, things start to come in and you build up your CV and you keep going. But it's definitely felt like, you know, a slow build. But I think at the same time, I learned so much from it. And I feel like if I'd gotten a job like this straight out of drama school, I just wouldn't be able to handle it. You know, like my mental health even wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yes.
Because it's quite, you know, it's all kind of all consuming and, you know, all eyes on you and all that kind of thing.
But you're equipped.
Yeah. Like I'm older now. I've put the work in. I've done the work on myself. I've done the work on my craft and I know that a job is a job. You know, it's no reflection really on me as a human being, mm-hmm. like me as Amy the person. You know, I want to do a good job as Amy the actor, but I've been able to, over the years, separate myself from my craft in a good way, in a healthy way.
Of course. I was talking to an author recently, Megan Nolan, and she went to Trinity and lasted a year and just said, nah, it's just not for me. And off she went and now is a very successful writer. That kind of mirrors your experience a little bit, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of left school and it was kind of at that time, you know, drama schools weren't so much a thing over here back then, you know, like it was a much smaller industry and all of that. And so I kind of in my back of my head thought, oh, maybe London for drama school. But is that even a possibility? It wasn't on the CAO form and all of that. So I just put down English in Trinity and got it and kind of arrived there. And I was going, what am I doing here? Like there was people who had this, you know, insane knowledge of everything to do with English. And I was kind of going, I loved reading plays, but I wanted to be doing them. I didn't want to be sort of studying them in that kind of, you know, in that way.
Yes.
So, and I just kind of took a leap. I wasn't well. I lasted a couple of months, wasn't very well. And my mum is really good. My mum's the type of person who's like, if you don't like it, just leave, you know, there's no, you've nothing to prove, you know? So, it was actually the best thing I ever did. Yeah. Glandular fever basically,
okay.
But when I look back on it, it was very, you could see it was stress and, you know,
it was totally related
to not being happy.
But wasn't your mum in the same, or sorry, I don't know if she's still in the same business or if she's retired or whatever, but wasn't she from a similar background? Is that right?
Yeah. So she used to be my speech and drama teacher.
Oh my God.
Yeah. She's actually going to be in a film as well. She's got a part in the film, The Green Knight. That'll be
great.
She does a bit of directing as well. She's directed my one woman shows. So it's and my older sister's an actor as well. So it's definitely in the family for sure. So, you know, kind of to leave somewhere like Trinity and say, I want to be an actor was not going to be kind of like, what are you doing? You know, it was accessible. It felt accessible.
Great. So there's no gig and unhappy Christmas meals. It was just great. Just keep going. Follow your dream. Keep going.
Yeah, exactly.
And Amy plays the part of Liverpoolian Steph Corbett in The Line of Duty.
I auditioned in the accent. The read-through in the last series was in the accent and then again in this one. So it's funny, I always just say a misspent youth watching Brookside was what I was channeling. It was literally like, I used to be obsessed with that programme. So as a child, which is very strange, but there you go.
No. It was a great, funny enough, as a younger person, Brookside had a certain edge to it that was, you know, remember Brian Murray and the Under the Patio, and it was all these stories.
Yeah.
The storylines were just, they had a bit of a more of an edge to them, I think.
Yeah, and I remember someone being pushed off scaffolding and, you know, oh, brilliant. It was, great.
So you channeled Brookside.
So I channeled Brookside, and then I was doing it when I was doing the first read through. I think I only found out just before I was doing the first read through that Stephen Graham was playing my husband.
Yeah.
And then you get the fear because you're going, oh God, he's going to find, I'm going to be found out. But he said he didn't know I wasn't from Liverpool.
Well, that's such a compliment, because you're obviously so good at it that. Because there are plenty of actors from Liverpool they could have cast in this role, and you know they got you because obviously you shone through. And he is, I was watching him in that the Bamber murder case, the program I never remember the name of. He's a super actor, as you know. And just for not to get into too much detail about Line of Duty, because if you haven't seen, it's quite boring to hear people talk about it. But it's he's dead. And you came back to this season, and I was going, what's Amy doing here?
I know.
What are you doing here? You weren't meant to be kind of gone off weeping into your cornflakes. What are you doing back? And you've had two encounters with two of the main characters. I'm going, what is she up to?
Oh, it's so brilliant. Yeah, because you get like, I sort of left the programme going, that was a gorgeous gig. That was beautiful. Like, I loved it. I got on really well, and I knew that the writer, Jed, had liked my work because he did bring me back for the feature length finale in series 5. And then I got the call, and I'd actually just had like my little girl, and I was kind of going like dying to get back to work. And then I get the call kind of going, well, we think they might be bringing you back. Will you be available? I was like, oh, yes. Yes. It's just an incredible, it's a incredible thing to go back to, and a real, and Jed is such a good writer. When you finish the series, it'll all make sense. But it's just, it's just incredible to be back. It is a dream, like a dream come true, really, because it was really a dream job. It really was. And to come back, it is a real kind of a mark of like, okay, I did an okay job. Because you kind of do your job and you go, was that okay? Okay,
yeah, of course.
That's grand, but hopefully nobody is horrified by it, you know?
Oh, but Amy, like I'm talking to you going, oh, I really want to ask you what happens, but then I don't want to know, because that's what the point of a good drama or a good book is. You don't want to ask somebody what's happening in the next chapter, because then that's what's the point. You're going to earn the pain and the fact that it's dropping every week. This is like Dallas in the 80s. Like, who's H? Who shot JR? Like, this is intriguing.
Because the first episode that we watched, it was so funny. We just sat there and then we were like, oh God, we can't binge this. We've just been spending a whole year binging everything.
But isn't that, I think that's really putting manners on us.
Yes, it is. And I think that was kind of a point of it. Like, I saw that the BBC had said, no, we're doing it the old fashioned way. And that's, it gives you so much more. It gives you just things to talk about. And it was so funny. My sister was going, that's great now, Amy. That'll get us through the next few weeks. You know, we've got this to focus on.
And, you know, even upstairs, we're all fans. And the comment was made, you know, you remember the Glen Rowe fear that you get at 8:30 and you hear the sick tune and your nerves were gone because you knew school was the next day? Well, with Line of Duty, when you hear the music at the end, you go, oh.
Yes.
Is it next week yet? No.
Oh my God.
I can't believe Amy's back. What's she doing? And Dunbar, I still don't know whether I love him or hate him. I don't get this. Do we have to wait a whole week? Oh, can't take it. I'd like to binge everything. Who's killing who and why? Oh, for jeepers. Sorry, I just lost the plot there.
It takes you somewhere, like that music. And I always raise my fist really slowly in the air after each episode. I was like, I really do when that music comes on.
I was sent a website, or at least a page or two, on the day after the first episode, with an explaining note of all the acronyms.
I know.
Because Jed Mercurio loves a good acronym.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a devil for them. So much so that when everyone's going, what's Chiz? And we can do the finar later, but everyone's saying, you know, you've got to get his hands on the Chiz and so on. And everyone was laughing into their sleeve going, but then, going, what is it? And obviously people, like somebody said earlier on, sent in a text going, oh, we Googled it immediately. I didn't. And then the credits come up and this happened.
Next episode, next Sunday at 9. Chiz, if you're wondering, is a covert human intelligence source for more...
Oh!
Yes, I loved the way they did that. Because
yeah, so do I.
The announcer there was going like, no one is going to know.
And Ryan wondered if Amy is watching the show every week like the rest of us.
So it's myself and my husband watching it. And very funny though, like last week, like baby's always in bed by then, but last week... She was sort of like, she was up till about 8 and I was going, you want to watch this too, you will go to sleep.
How old is she?
She's 21 months now, so she's nearly 2. Like, she's not even, I say baby, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, yeah.
So I was kind of like trying to get her down, and then I've got the sisters and my parents on a WhatsApp group, and it's like, rah, you know, and then the best friend on the other. It's very funny, and I actually have to just put the phone down on silent and just be able to watch it because it's going, I need to like take in this moment.
You know what? I was saying this earlier on in the week that when I'm watching it, I'm watching another thing called Gomorrah at the moment, which is an Italian, basically love hate based in Naples. And because I have to read it because it's subtitles. I don't touch my phone. You know the way you're kind of messing on the phone. Whereas and actually, I find Line of Duty exactly the same because it needs your attention.
Yes.
No messing on the phone. Watch it because it's so. They could be flicking through a file and there'd be a picture in the file. You go, that's relevant too. Every bit of it is used. There's no fat on the bone.
And I love how there's so many little clues dropped everywhere and stuff that I'm not even picking up on. And then like I see someone's theory and I'm like, whoa, that's really interesting. Like you saw a thing somewhere and you know.
We have to. Well, Adrian Dunbar is joining us on the Late Late Show tonight.
Lucky you guys.
And lucky us. And so we'll have to talk to him about, well, he's obviously this and so much more. But you had a little encounter with him on the episode just gone by. You had Steve giving you the glad eye in between his pill popping. Mm. We all know what a chiz is now, thank God. And there's so much more to come. So, Amy, I'm not going to ask you, can I be part of your WhatsApp group? Because I'll be...
you'll of course take a, you can. We're best buds now.
Yeah, it's true.
As always.
A, you'll have to take an injunction out on me. But B, also, I don't want to be on my phone watching this thing because it's great.
I know, that's but, the thing.
Amy De Bruyne on The Ryan Tubridy Show. And in the morning, with the 5K rule in place for the Easter bank holiday weekend, Claire Byrne was talking about the pressures on tourism hotspots. Rita McInerney is a business owner in Doonbeg in Clare.
Rita, I'll start with you because I know you've you're concerned, aren't you, about the number of people you've seen coming into Doonbeg in recent days. Maybe just paint a picture for us of what's been happening there.
Yes, well, I suppose there has been an increase in visitors to the area over the last few days, particularly. And it is a concern because I suppose the numbers have been quite low in Clare and everybody's working hard and doing their bit. And, you know, it is concerning then to see people travelling from a distance and not knowing where exactly they're coming from. And I really understand people's need to get out, and we're blessed with beautiful beaches and scenery and walks here in Clare, but you know, we are concerned in relation to the numbers of people coming in and how that would impact on communities. And you know, our visitors are so important, they're so welcomed, we love having them, they're so loyal, they come year on year and throughout the year indeed. But, you know, we are in the middle of a pandemic and it is a crisis point.
And Rita, what are you basing this on now? You're seeing, is it just more people around, or do you notice that the car regs are not local?
Both, yes, definitely. The car regs certainly aren't local a lot of the time. And in terms of the business, yes, we are seeing people coming in. And, you know, people will say, well, why are you talking about this when, you know, it's good for business, but it's not good for our community. You know, we, in a normal circumstance, we'd be looking forward to a bumper Easter weekend and love having people here. But, you know, we are hugely concerned and people's health takes precedence over business. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that, you know, that maybe looking at the regional areas in terms of people being able to travel, traditionally a lot of people from Limerick would come to West Clare and it's great to see, it's great to have them, and maybe to keep it at a regional level, and then that in other parts of the country that, that people stay within regions.
Oh, so if you had low numbers in Clare and Limerick, that you might be allowed to travel between both counties?
Exactly. That would be ideal situation, rather than, you know, if someone's going to take the chance of going, of travelling, they can go literally anywhere. If they're going to do it, they're going to do it and they're going to travel. Whereas if you're saying, well, right, stay within your region, within your two or three counties, well, then you're giving people lots of options in terms of places to visit, beaches, walks, lakes, whatever, in every part of our beautiful country has places that people can recreate.
You know, Rita, as you're talking there, you're very understanding about people's need to get away, but you haven't seen some of your family for a long time.
No, I haven't seen my family in Waterford and Dublin. I haven't seen them since last year, and even my brothers within the county, we very rarely see them, you know, since Christmas, because, you know, we don't see them at all, because it's not permissible. My father is 83 and eagerly waiting his second vaccine and looking forward to it, but he hasn't seen his grandkids. And it's the same in every household in the parish will tell you the same thing. They have family away and they're not daring to come down because they're thinking of their elderly loved ones in particular, and they won't come down in case they would risk transmitting anything or carrying anything with them. So, you know, that is difficult. And we do have vibrant communities here in Clare, and as I said, we love to see people coming. And I think...
But I think
the upside of the pandemic is people are probably reconsidering their work basis. And we have great digital hubs in Clare and in Enstymon and in Milltown and Kilrush and Kilkee. And people, if they would reconsider moving permanently to Clare, we would certainly welcome them.
And Professor Sam McConkie also spoke about hotspots this weekend.
There are two main reasons, you say, why you're not happy to see people travelling around the country to tourist hotspots. And it would seem obvious, but it's no harm for you to just outline those two reasons for us.
So the first is a bit like the Dublin GA team. When folks see others sort of not going along with our national rules of level 5, then that leads to a breakdown of trust and governance, and then others start to not follow the rules. So I think that we are a bit of a herd mentality as humans. And, you know, we've actually done really well for a year and 3 months to stick together in this, surprisingly to me. I'm delighted to say that. But if we have large amounts of people flaunting our level 5, then the whole thing will break down. And we really can only do this with voluntary cooperation. This sort of social restrictions and physical and social distancing, Claire, you can't do by any sort of force or military in a country like ours. It has to be a voluntary cooperation by consent. And that's what we've done so far. So if there's wide numbers of people, you know, seem to be flaunting the rules, then everyone sort of gives up, and we've no coordination of our 5 million people, and then our ability to work together as one falls a bit. The second reason, of course, is that there's actually a risk of people, particularly from areas, you know, we know there are 5 or 6 counties in Ireland where there's very, very high rates of outbreaks and so on, and thankfully there's pop-up testing in those areas happening. But if people from those higher areas, including, you know, parts of Dublin, go to the lower rates areas, then they risk reintroducing COVID into areas that are largely COVID-free. And that's sort of going backwards at this point.
Yeah, do you think, just going back to the social reason that you outlined there, do you think what's happening, what we're hearing about this weekend, what might occur over the Easter weekend, does that represent a breakdown in the whole structure around restrictions?
A little bit. I think it's quite small. We've got objective travel data from our mobile phones that move around. We can see how much people are travelling. And there certainly we're travelling now. Our version of Level 5, Claire, now at the beginning of April, is a bit more relaxed than our version back in January and February. So it's quite clear that there is a little bit more mobility. Now, that's just moving around in cars on our own. That's maybe not such a big deal. But ultimately, if you're going somewhere, you're inevitably going to be shopping and meeting people, potentially talking, potentially without a mask, potentially spreading the virus in an inter-county way that isn't helpful. So I think it's slight loss of control. I don't think it's dramatic at this point, but it's important, I think, to try and prevent and avoid that until we get several million people vaccinated, and then hopefully things can open up more.
And we were talking there at the start of the programme about the extension of the mandatory hotel quarantine to the 26 extra countries and states, but it didn't include some of the EU countries with very high infection rates and also the United States. Are you concerned?
Yes, I don't have the sort of inside data on how many variants of concern we're importing into Ireland from places like the United States and France and Germany and UK, that data probably exists somewhere in the NVRL, and the folk that have that will be able to see how many folk have COVID who've recently travelled in the last 14 days to those countries, and are they actually bringing in these variants. Of course, if they're bringing them in, it's, you know, perhaps slightly too late. So I am concerned that if we reintroduce COVID, you know, particularly, you know, we failed on this back in last May, June, July. We let it come back in and cause a second wave. So we don't want to make the same mistake again.
I have a message here from a person who says, my partner is travelling into Ireland from Israel. He's fully vaccinated. Why on earth does he have to face mandatory quarantine? It's an illogical decision and needs to be reversed. It doesn't really make sense, does it, that somebody who's fully vaccinated would be forced into mandatory hotel quarantine for 2 weeks?
So we've got really good data from mostly from the US in the last week or two that people who've been vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine, which I believe is what Israelis have, who are 2 weeks after the second dose, have very, very good protection from asymptomatic carriage and infection and transmission. So we're now getting strong transmission blocking evidence 2 weeks after the second vaccination. And that's why, of course, Taoiseach on the 29th of March announced that, you know, people who are fully vaccinated more than 2 weeks can actually meet up in each other's homes with no masks and no social distancing again, you know, which is a step forward. So I think inevitably there will be different rules for people who are fully vaccinated, as we're seeing. Now, that has to be sort of fully vaccinated, has to be clear what that means and when the doses were and the duration and so on. But I think that may be something to consider in the future.
Professor Sam McConkie from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, young Elsie was talking to Ryan.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
You sound great. Where are you?
In ovens in County Cork.
You're in an oven in County Cork? It must be hot there.
No, it's a place.
You know, what is it, about 180 degrees?
No, it's very cold.
Right, okay. And what age are you?
I'm 9.
9. Do you have any animals?
I have 2 fish at the moment, and I'm getting 2 dogs next week.
What? You wait for 1 dog all your life, and then 2 come along. It's like a bus. What dogs are you getting?
Well, my granduncle's dogs. Mm-hmm. One's a Jack Russell, and one's a type of a terrier.
Yeah. You're getting a terrorist?
A terrier.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were getting a strange dog in a balaclava. So you're getting 2 dogs, and what are their, do you know their names?
Well, no one's really sure of the names, so we're giving them new names, Carter and Charlie.
Why are you calling them that?
Well, I love Egypt and history about it, and I love reading books about it, and...
Is Carter one of the explorers?
Howard Carter,
Tutankhamun.
Yeah, and then Charlie, just because I just wanted to call him Charlie.
I love the way one minute you're like 99-year-old history expert and then you're just a 9-year-old girl who wants to call your dog Charlie. Like, that is, you're pretty impressed. Do you like reading?
Yeah, I love reading, especially like Harry Potter books Egypt history books.
Egypt, I think that's brilliant. What are your goldfish's names?
Let me guess. Reddy and Goldie.
I was going to say Tutan and Camoon, but Reddy and Goldie, you've got great names.
That's young Elsie from the Ryan Tubridy Show. And in the afternoon, Catherine Thomas was standing in for Ray Darcy, and Mary O'Rourke had just had her second jab.
Great. Nothing wrong. I felt a bit of an ache in my left arm, but it's gone.
Okay.
No, fine, yeah. Thank goodness it's all over and I've had my 2 vaccines.
So, it being April Fool's Day as well, when you got the call up, when you got the phone call.
I said, oh, this is a big fat joke. But it wasn't. It was for real. And there were quite a few there of my age group getting it yesterday. Mm. And it was very swift and well done and executed and away we went. Mm. But honestly, I'm so happy to have it over me.
I know. And really, what, you know, in 2 weeks' time, it will have fully taken effect for you. So what does that mean for you? I mean, how is that going to change?
Well, what is going to change is, first of all, I'll meet my children, my grandchildren. I've 2 sons, one in Dublin and one in Athlone. And the one in Athlone has 4 children. Mm. And I haven't seen any of them since the big lockdown. They sometimes come in with Angus, that's my son. He brings me in some food and newspapers and things like that. And they would stay out in the garden and wave in at me. Mm. But I'm so longing to have a big hug, a good tight hug from them. And that's what I'm looking forward to, mostly.
Yeah.
And then able to go out in my car. And now I think they're lifting it from 5 kilometres. Doesn't matter. The Hudson Bay fits into the 5 kilometres. So I'll drive out there in my car. I won't interact with anybody. Mm. I'll sit in the car with my book and a newspaper and look out at the lovely lake water and the ducks and children playing and all that kind of thing. And that would be fabulous.
Mm.
That's where I was brought up, in the Hudson Bay. And then I'll come back in home and I'll be so different. So gradually, I hope, Catherine, it's going to open up, you know.
Mm. And I mean, for you, I know, and I've been, you know, keeping up and reading bits and pieces that you've done. I know the rugby on the TV has kept you sane, keeping up with politics, the radio, all sorts of bits and pieces. When things open up altogether, Mary, what are you looking forward to?
Well, when things open up altogether, I'm looking forward to meeting my two sons and daughters-in-law, and maybe when they really, really open up, that we can have an outdoor meal somewhere, because I think that's on the cards in June, May, June.
What about getting the hair done?
Oh, the hair. Oh, if you saw my photograph in the paper today, my hair is a show.
Ah.
It's the length of it. You know, I never had long hair. I'd love to get a scissors, but I'd be terrified I'd do wrong. No, hairdressers are my number one go-to.
I don't know
when they're opening up. I think it's in May.
Yes. Yeah. And the other thing, just when I was reading the piece in the Indo, your article today, one of the funny things that came up was people's ages. With this vaccine, people's ages are being revealed. So there was a lot of people...
I think that's terribly funny, because sometimes maybe they want to, quite rightly, a lot of people, particularly women, don't go around saying, I'm this age and I'm this age. I always knew everyone in Athlone would know my age. But suddenly, you know people's age if they're doing from 80 to 85 and you hear such and such a person has had the vaccine. So you know roughly what age they are. So that's a kind of a great revelation.
Well,
you
know what? It reminded me, my Nana, God rest her, she's passed away, but she got into awful trouble. She used to always lie about her age, right? Because she never liked admitting the age that she was.
And it came
to some sort of insurance problem. She had to produce two documents, and she'd actually altered her birth. So her birth cert and her passport didn't match.
I know. Well, she had her come up, and then she...
Mary O'Rourke with Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. And back to Aideen Gormley's interview with Julie Andrews. And Julie speaks about playing Maria in The Sound of Music and whether she knew just how popular the film would become.
No, you can never tell that any movie. You hope that it's not going to disappoint, but you cannot quite guess at the amount of success it might be. Sometimes you hope that it'll be really well received because you enjoy making it so much, but especially the musicals. But I don't know. It's a great treat when something is nominated, but the work itself is actually the biggest pleasure, I think.
When it came to being asked to star in The Sound of Music, was it an immediate yes for you?
Was it an instant yes? No, not exactly. I think I somewhere in the back of my head, I hoped, and I mean, I wasn't one to pick and choose in those days. I was a rank newcomer. But nevertheless, I wondered if playing two nannies in very short order might typecast me. And to an extent, it did. I was worried that people would only think of me in a kind of squeaky, clean, white bread sort of way. But the body of work these days, thank goodness, has sort of speaks for itself. But at that time, it did occur to me that it might be a little difficult. But the pleasure of that movie far outweighed those concerns. And
And all of us in the movie, of course, decided that we would try to make it as astringent as possible, given the potential saccharine themes that could drown us all. And of course, everybody, including our lovely director, Robert Wise, was acutely aware that Sound of Music had to be as real and as astringent as possible.
Yes, and again, you give us such wonderful detail about the filming of it and about the songs, the seven Von Trapp children already rehearsing by the time you arrived. The first song you say you recorded was My Favourite Things, where, you know, there you were just starting to bond with the kids, I would imagine. And I love your little bit of information about the decision to speak the first phrase as opposed to singing it.
Yes, it was mutually agreed. It came from our musical the man in charge of all the sound, and including the performances and so on. He said, you know, I think it would be nice if you eased into the song and made it part of a dialogue. And I couldn't agree more, because launching into song is kind of somehow didn't feel right. And he hit it exactly right when he suggested that, and I embraced it instantly.
And how was it filming that first song with the seven kids around you?
Well, it was a very good one to begin the movie with. First of all, it's a beautiful song and great fun. And the kids were lovely. And I saw, as nervous as I was, I saw how nervous they were. And so I decided to sort of make it as easy on them as possible, too. And so I teased them a little bit in close-ups and made them smile. And they asked me to sing Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, which they'd heard about, but the film hadn't been released when we were filming that. So I was able to share it with them, and they loved it. We bonded very quickly.
How did you get on initially with the yodeling?
I can't yodel. I still can't, Aidan. But, you know, I faked it, and I guess I faked it well enough, thanks to my kind of high voice. But it's not an easy thing. I have a huge respect for really good yodelers. It's a whole different way of singing, and it's a throwing of the voice and a hardening of the voice and something that I wasn't used to at all.
A certain sadness, too, when you remind us that Edelweiss was the last song Oscar Hammerstein ever wrote.
Yes. Oh, my goodness me. And what a beautiful song. When all is said and done, I think it is my favourite song in the film. I've subsequently sung it a lot because I do so enjoy it. And it's no accident, I suppose, that it is my favourite song in the film, because, again, it's about home, and the book is called Homework. And home is about everything to do with feeling rooted and set in a place that's warm and embracing and comfortable, whether it be one's real home or one's country or a movie set, really, to be corny.
From Aidan Gormley, stars of stage and screen, Julie Andrews. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.